someone who seems to have exited the struggle at a very vital and pivotal moment was Ahmed Kathrada, a struggle hero, former political prisoner, someone who spent time on Robben Island with Madiba. He spoke about the Rivonia raid. He spoke about his adjustment to modern technology when he was released, the last time he saw Madiba, and many other things. But Ahmed Kathrada, the struggle hero, political prisoner, and in the end of his life, also a conscientious objector to the way that the ANC was turning out, was one of our favorite guests. His nickname, Kathy. He was born in 1929 and lived to see the ANC change completely from his beloved struggle, freedom-fighting party of substance to a party that he could no longer recognize and which he distanced himself from towards the end. His funeral became a lightning rod for so much commentary about the Jacob Zuma regime and where it had gone wrong. And since his death, many people utter his name in hallowed tones as one of the last real struggle stalwarts. So I was pleased to have spent a bit of time with Ahmed Kathrada and picked his brain and asked him some difficult questions about where we are now, but more especially about his history and the history of South Africa. Ahmed Mohammed Kathrada, who was born in 1929, and he's known by the nickname Kathy, but he is one of those people who was incarcerated on Robben Island for the same duration, just a little bit shorter than Madiba, but he was locked up from 1963 in the original treason trial. He and the others were found not guilty, and then in 63, in that trial, they were all sent to Robben Island, and it is a pleasure and an honor to welcome someone who I've met a few times before, but it's always very, very good to see you. Ahmed Kathrada, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good, good. I hope you don't mind being here so early on a Monday morning. I apologize for having woken you up.
No, I still stick to prison time.
You do? You're still up early every morning?
Yeah.
Sure. It's a hell of a life you've lived up to now. I mean, you must sometimes wake up in the morning and think, sure, I can't believe the life I've had. The things I've experienced.
That's now ancient history. So.
I don't know so much. I mean, you're obviously still very involved in many things. And you're still the sort of person who everybody looks to as almost a village elder. We go to you when we need perspective on things because you have such a wide context to compare things to. And you lived among people who, and you are yourself, we regard as legends. These are people who have contributed an enormous way to the South Africa we have now. This is no small thing. You can't just go up to the mirror and go, oh, Ahmed, you're just getting older.
No, we try to adjust as the situation demands. Yeah.
But you're not sentimental about it.
I can't say that I'm completely free of sentiment. I think without being sentimental, I'm not myself.
Sure. And there's obviously emotion. I know that you were very, very emotional when Madiba died because he was a very close friend of yours and you spent a lot of time together on the island. And I know you've seen some of your other comrades pass on.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to be difficult. You're almost the survivor of that group.
Yeah.
Do you think it's easier to be one of the ones who's left at the end, or do you think it's harder?
I didn't get your question.
Well, you are one of the people who's still around.
Yeah.
Out of that group, that very tight-knit community of people who were in prison together from 1963. Is it harder or easier to be one of the people who's there at the end?
Well, the fewer survivors, the greater the responsibility, because more and more demands are made on our time. Because we are few who survived. And in my particular case, of the three major court cases, I'm the only one alive. There were only three people who were in all three, Mandela, Sisulu, and myself.
Wow.
So that sort of makes it not difficult, but more and more demands are made, especially by the media and historians who want to cover those periods. Yeah.
But you have a story to tell. I'm sure you don't mind telling it, because you know also that it's hugely important, and this is information which is vital to us building a picture of the past so that we don't forget these things and we are able to move into the future in an informed way. So I know that it must annoy you sometimes when you don't have any time. Because really, a man of your age should be able to retire and enjoy your life a little bit now. You've earned it.
Well, you know, retirement, literally, if it's retirement, one fades away.
That's not going to happen for you. I saw you on a plane the other day. You're flying up and down the whole time. You're a very busy man.
Well, you know, another prison habit, I take orders.
So you've established the foundation. I would imagine most of those orders come from the Katrada Foundation.
That's right.
Right. So they tell you your diary is this. You've got to go and talk to this idiot Gareth Cliff this morning. Then you've got to go here. You've got to do this. You've got to do that.
Talking about that, they've got hold of my diaries.
Yes.
Except for two, which they're still trying to find.
The ones that you started in prison or before then?
No, after the prison.
Okay.
And I was quite surprised myself when they totaled the number of times I accompanied people to Robben Island is 300 times.
That's a lot of time to spend in a place that didn't exactly give you joy. I know that you've been more involved than anyone else in Robben Island's preservation.
Yeah, well, the experiences are something that need to be conveyed.
Yes.
And that's what we try to do with all the visitors that we accompany.
Well, since you've been on the island so many times with visitors, I don't think you will remember, but you did take me on a tour there once. It was many years ago. We did a broadcast from the island. And I think it might have been one of the first times that people broadcast live from the island. And we actually stayed there overnight, uh-huh. Which was incredible, because I got a feeling for the first time, and I think we were the only people left on the island that night, I got a feeling of how desolate and alone and removed from Cape Town, just across there, you can see the lights, you actually are when you're on there, and how dark and still it is.
Well, while we had the company of our leadership and friends, but one misses most is the absence of children.
Mm.
I literally saw and touched a child. It was after 20 years.
It's a long time to be separated from any happy, youthful sounds. And
that was not on Robben Island. That was at Portsmouth Prison, where things, because there were only five of us political prisoners, so things were a bit relaxed.
Yeah.
So they did. They departed from regulations, and this child came along with her father, who was a lawyer, and she wouldn't stay in the car. So they allowed her to come in.
I was reading about you last night, and I read that you started becoming politically active at age 12.
Yeah.
12 years old, it seems to me very young. 12-year-olds aren't what they used to be, huh?
No, but at that age, one is attracted to what we call in those days bicycles and picnics and so forth.
Yes.
And in Fortsburg, you know, I had to come at the age of 8 to Johannesburg for schooling.
Because you couldn't get education if you'd stayed in Schweizerenica where you were born. You couldn't have been educated there because they didn't allow Indian or black children to learn.
Well, I was not allowed into the white school nor into the African school.
So there was nowhere
and there was no Indian school. So at the age of 8, I had to come to Johannesburg. But in Fortsburg, there was a youth club run by the Young Communist League. And got interested in the films and picnics and lectures. And I got drawn into the Young Communist League at the age of 12.
There must have been some very interesting people at that age who were already starting to influence you, though.
The person I'll never ever forget is Ruth Slovo, or Ruth First as she was known.
Ruth First.
She was one of the leaders of the Young Communist League, and I met her at that time already. And then, of course, we all through her life, we became closer and closer. Until, of course...
until she was killed.
I said goodbye to her when we were hiding, when I was hiding at Lily's Leaf Farm, disguised. And I was a bit disturbed, very disturbed, in fact, about the flouting of security.
At Lily's Leaf.
At Lily's Leaf.
You thought this is no longer kept as secret as it should be, and we've got to be careful because they could come and find us.
That's right. So, you know, we were careless. The Lily's Leaf belonged to the Communist Party.
Right.
Under very, very strict conditions, people who were not regulars had to undergo a whole process before they were allowed. But when the ANC people took over, because, you know, they had to act in a hurry for so many things, so in the process, security was flouted quite a bit. So much so that the foreman, a black chap, who was an old-time communist, he had to bring it over to attention. He says, you fellows are being irresponsible.
Hmm.
Known cars, known number plates are now coming to Lily's Leaf during the daytime. And
you knew
he
were...
had to remind us how careless we were about security at Lily's Leaf.
You knew they were watching you, and you had to be careful.
I don't think they were watching. They tried to.
Mm.
The chappie who I think eventually gave us up, was under detention, and the policeman, one of the 16 police who raided us, I had a few hours with him at Lily's Leaf, and he told us that this man who broke down under interrogation, under torture, could not identify the farm. So they took 12 trips with him at night, trying to identify Lily's Leaf Farm. Eventually, the board, RIVONIA, it wasn't complete, I think, you know, just a part of Rivonia was on the board. And that's how they got to the farm, just through this board, incomplete signage.
That's what he remembered.
That's how this policeman told me.
Hmm. Now, in the movie Long Walk to Freedom, they reenacted the scene of the farm being raided and of all of you being caught. I don't know if you can recall how they put it together in the movie. They may have asked you to help them figure out how it all actually happened. I don't remember. But... is that more or less accurate, that these police swept in, you guys weren't really prepared, they caught you, you were trying to jump through windows, trying to get out through back entrances, trying to destroy as much material as you could so that they wouldn't find your plans? Is that how it happened? It was that quick?
We were, you see, by the time that they arrested us, we had all left Lily's Leaf. For our own places.
Right.
30 years of my life I was an Indian, and they disguised me as a Portuguese. So I had to go and live in a white area.
Yeah.
But of course, fortunately, the owners of this garden cottage, they knew who I was. So in case of police inquiries, they were able to say, well, this man answered an advert, and there was no reason for us not to believe who he claimed to be.
Right.
So I stayed there. Others also went. All of us left Lily's Leaf. The ANC people got a place of their own. I was in the Communist Party, so I had a place of my own. But then we had to discuss a very important document called Operation Mayabuya,
right,
which would take in the next phase of the struggle. And we had to have a meeting. And we couldn't find a safe venue.
Mayabuya would have taken, just so that we can understand, Mayabuya would have taken the next phase of the struggle out of passive aggression, out of passive resistance, and into...
No, from the first phase of the sabotage phase.
Right.
Where bombs were placed in Europeans-only places and all that, the next phase would have been armed combat.
And that would have also been targeting specific government institutions and offices.
Well, the armed combat would have, but we never ever reached that stage.
Right.
I can't even visualize what...
it might have been.
Because, in fact, this document called Operation Mayabuya got a lot of debate for and against. Bram Fischer, in his court case, he didn't use these words, but he suggested that this Operation Mayabuya was a product of high school children. It was, you know, they just fiddled with figures that the two people who drew it up.
Yeah.
5,000 trained people will be ready to receive the first trained people who come by helicopter. Things like that, you know.
Okay.
But so they were completely divorced.
It was actually pie in the sky, really. The idea of Mayabuya was sort of, it was made up on the spot, basically.
It was made up by two people, but my very dear comrades, of course, but they were a bit divorced from reality when they, you know, you can't imagine, you can be staying at Lily's Leaf in remote, you know, and you don't really know what's happening in Soweto.
Yeah. Now, you were busy saying they had this project, Mayabuya, that they were working on. But at that point when the raid happened,
document was there.
Yes.
Rusty Bernstein, the late Rusty, he and I myself and one or two others were completely against it as an unworkable document.
Mm-hmm.
And when we met that day, and we were told beforehand by Bob Happel, because we had all left Lily's Leaf. He said, well, this will be the last time because we didn't have a venue to discuss Rusty's input against Mayabuya.
Okay.
So we gathered there and the Mayabuya was on the table. Before we could even start, the police came.
What was the first thing that tipped you off that they were there?
No, from where we're sitting, we were staying in this domestic workers. Even when we were hiding, even Madiba, he was not staying in the main house. He was disguised as a farm laborer and staying in the domestic workers' room. And that's where we were staying. And so that's where we were meeting.
Did you see the cars come in?
Yes. We could see this. You see, at first we didn't take notice because Arthur Goldreich, who was the front man who occupied the big house.
Yes.
Well, being a family man, we were used to seeing laundry, butchers, dry cleaners, all vans coming in. So we didn't take notice on that particular day when this van, I think it was a laundry van, drew up. And we continued until the back doors opened and the police jumped out.
Oof.
So they didn't come to the servants' quarters first. They went into the main house, and there they found Dennis Goldberg. He was not part of a meeting. He had just driven Sisulu and them from where they were hiding. He had driven them to Lily's Leaf, and he was waiting for them in the main house. So they first got him. And when they discovered that we were there, I believe they said, once at the jackpot.
Because they found everyone else in the back.
Yeah.
Did you try and run?
Two of us tried to jump out of the back window, but the whole place was surrounded by armed police and dogs.
So did you just put your hands up?
Well, we didn't put our hands up, but we just stopped trying to run. That's
right.
All.
And did they immediately sort of, cuff you? How did it work? Did they put handcuffs on?
Yes. They handcuffed us.
Did they line you all up? Did they put you in one room or did they put you in the back of the van immediately? How did it work?
Well, once they completed identifying, for instance, it took a little time before they immediately identified me.
Okay.
And once they identified us, they put us in the van and took us to the Johannesburg Fort, where we stayed for 2 nights, and then we were transferred to Pretoria.
Now, this is a group of people, a seminal moment in South African history, because this could have been the end of the ANC and Kwanto Asizwe in Johannesburg. All your major leadership were arrested. It could have meant the end of the organization. I mean, it could very much have damaged all the operational aspects of the ANC and Kwanto Asizwe then. But you then also had to deal with the fact that all of you were together, and it was your responsibility to do something about this. The trial itself must have been looming, and you must have been interested in how that would go, because it would have paved the way for your own future. But when you were in that courtroom in Pretoria, you, Madiba, Walter Sisulu, and again, I walked into that courtroom the other day and just I thought about all of you sitting in the dock. It's a fairly intimidating place.
Yeah.
It's a big room. Have you been in there again since then?
Yes, in fact, we were there.
How does it feel to go
just,
in there?
I was there with George Bezos, who was one of our lawyers. Yeah.
How does it feel to be in there again?
You know, that all that has become routine.
I know, but surely...
As with Robben Island...
Do you ever look at the walls? Do you ever look at the wood in front of you there in that dock and think, in this room, my fate was decided. I lost some years of the best years of my life because of a decision made in here.
You see, as far as I can recall, visiting the court was not as traumatic as Robben Island.
Right.
When we first landed there.
Now, when you first landed, there were some very mean people that met you on the ground. You were flown in.
There were 8 of us who were sentenced, and Dennis Goldberg, being white, was kept in Pretoria. And 7 of us were suddenly woken up, handcuffed, leg irons, taken to the military airport where they removed the shackles. And it was the first time they had prepared a special runway on the island for the plane to land. And we landed on a very cold winter's day, rainy day, on the 13th of June, I think it was. We landed on Robben Island. Seven of us, of course. And of the 7, I was, at the age of 34, I was the youngest.
Mm.
Not the youngest on Robben Island, because we had, for instance, the present deputy judge president, Dihang Moseneke.
Mm-hmm.
He was 15.
That's right.
And there were others who were young, but I'm talking of our group. At the age of 34, I was the youngest. And I was the only Indian. Now I'm saying this deliberately, because now you're dealing with apartheid in prison.
Right.
The first thing we had to do was to change into prison clothes. And there was apartheid laws applying to Indians and coloreds, and to whites, and to Africans. Different laws.
You got to wear long pants.
That's it. So that was it. When they came to changing into prison clothes, I was given long pants. And as I said, I was the youngest of the 7. It was humiliating, because here are my leaders and my elders in age, all because they were Africans, had to wear short pants. The rationale, of course, at that time, the mentality was all Africans were boys. So you had little children talking of my garden boy, my kitchen girl.
Mm.
Boys wear short trousers.
Right.
And that was the rationale behind short trousers for even elders. I was given long trousers.
So you immediately protested and said...
Well, you know, instinctively, one wants to protest. And that's where Madiba comes into the picture. You never give up what you've got. We'll fight for improvement and equality, but you don't give up what you've got. And he convinced us not to give up anything.
Now,
then came the food discrimination, was even worse.
What was the food discrimination?
Well, in the morning we had the same food, porridge, soup, coffee. And then in the evening we had, Indians and colors had caught a loaf of bread. Mandela and the Africans got bread for the first time after 10 years. Now that is regulations. But at the same time, I must make it clear, you know, we, about 25 of us, were completely separated from the rest of the hundreds and hundreds. And among us, there were about a dozen of us who were either Indian or colored. So when things relaxed, we were able to put our food together, which couldn't happen in the communal cells because there were hundreds. Yeah. We were only about 25. And about a dozen of us were either Indian or colored. So we could share our bread or put it aside. I mean, together.
Mm. And then everyone would get some.
Yeah.
On Robben Island, there was the hard labor, which was part of what made it so miserable. But there was also, I mean, there wasn't a lot in these cells. I looked at it when I was there, and we've all seen the pictures and everything, but I don't think it entirely gives you an idea of how it must have felt to have such minimal resources and to be treated really like an incarcerated animal, because they weren't particularly kind or thoughtful, especially in the beginning. And those years in the 60s must have been the hardest.
The 60s were very bad, but again, in the what we call B section or the isolation section, we never experienced violence. There was a lot of violence in the communal cells. Mm. But at the same time, must say that no political prisoner was killed on Robben Island. The killings took place by the police before your court case, but not on Robben Island. Although there was a lot of violence, but not where we were staying. There was absolutely no violence.
Were you able to communicate quite freely, or was it difficult to communicate, to have conversations?
Among ourselves?
Among yourselves.
Well, we were in single cells. After we come back from work, no talking. Mm. But then the advantage was going out to work, first for 6 months just breaking stones in the courtyard with hammers. But then for 13 years we worked at the
quarry.
Lime quarry with pick and shovels. Now, that was a great advantage. You could work in groups. And right from the beginning, we had taken a decision. Because the first thing, you've got to stamp your dignity. And certain things you don't tolerate. You don't tolerate vulgarity. You don't tolerate commands which were not practicable. All that.
Yes.
You assert your dignity. The warders at that time had never worked with political prisoners. So they tried to carry on as they did with criminal prisoners, where they learned very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, in our section, there were absolutely no assaults. There was a lot of shouting and all that. But when they used vulgarity, we refused to take the orders. So may I just fast forward to one little incident?
Please.
In this communal cells, there was a section where people who were punished were kept there. So one of our colleagues was punished and deprived of food. So one of our friends talked to the warder at night, collected about food, bit of bread, and take it to this fellow. He was doing something illegal.
Right.
So he came back from, we'll call him James.
Yes.
He comes back from James with the same food. So Billy asked him, but we sent this food, why did you bring it back? He said, yeah, James said, klaar se tanda ka borsel.
He already brushed his teeth, didn't want to take your food. you must have struggled to find occasion for humor in there.
All that. If you don't have humor, prison can be hell.
So you would find reasons to laugh.
Oh, yes. There's plenty of reasons to laugh. some of it was teasing Walter.
What, who out of all of you political prisoners, who was the one who kind of kept your spirits up? Because there's always one joker in the pack.
Well, I have to plead guilty.
Not as much. That's why I'm asking.
No, I had enjoyed this relationship, particularly with people like Madiba and Walter.
Yes.
But particularly Walter, who was really a father to me, but such a wonderful human being. He was the father of everybody. At the same time, one could tease him.
Yes.
He was a bit absent-minded, and he was the butt of many jokes. But the advantage was that he took these things quite well.
He wasn't serious about it.
For instance, there's in a book written by a former prisoner where he said that when Shiba left prison after 18 years, he gave away everything. He says the person who was more generous than Shiba was Walter Sisulu. He also gave away everything, but he gave other people's things away. Unconsciously. You know, prisoners from the communal cells will, as plumbers, electricians, they'd get to our section.
Yes.
And they'd go straight to Walter.
Uh-huh.
Now, his family was not well off. He had very limited things in his cell.
Yes.
Little goodies, you know.
Trinkets and things.
Yeah. So they go to him. He'll empty everything that he's got. I was opposite him.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I'm there or not, he'll go into my cell, give away my things. Go into Mac Maharaj's cell, give away everything. But nobody would complain because it's Walter.
When he said, you say did he give them as gifts?
Hmm?
Did he give these things as gifts?
Yes. I mean, you see, the prisoners from the communal cell will go straight to him.
Because he'll give
them things. Tata was short of soap. Tata was short of toothpaste.
Sure.
He'd give away everything that he's got. I was opposite, diagonally opposite him. He'll give away my things, Maharaj's things. He'll just walk into any cell and give away things. But nobody complains.
Who were your neighbors?
My immediate neighbor was the late Joe Kabi, who was assassinated in Zimbabwe.
Yes.
Opposite me was Professor Neville Alexander.
Yeah.
And a few others. And diagonally was Walter.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Do you ever get together with, say, Mac Maharaj, who's still around too, and reminisce about these things and laugh about Walter giving away your soap and things like that?
Well, we haven't done it in an organized way.
He's also very busy.
Yeah, informally we meet and reminisce. I'm trying to organize something again. Just to reminisce, but now Walter is not there and Madiba is not there. But still, those of us who are there can still reminisce.
I don't know whether a lot of people know about what happened, because there's some mystery for most of us around what happened between when you left Robben Island and went to Polesmore and 1990 when Madiba was released. Because that there were some interesting things that went on behind the scenes there. You might not have been privy to the meetings Madiba was having, but you were allowed slowly to have more and more information until eventually all of you were released in 1989. Do you want to tell us the story of what happened in those years? Because for a lot of people, that's where things started to change before the country knew that they were starting.
Well, first of all, Ms. Mikke, after 3 years, clothing was equal.
Right.
Madiba and them, after 10 years, food was equal.
Hmm.
But after 18 years on Robben Island, five of us were transferred to Polesmore Prison. Now, that was different altogether. Because there was only five, there was complete relaxation. And there was smuggling, easy smuggling. The main warder, young chap, Brandt, he's still around.
Mm-hmm.
Now we are friends.
Yes.
Friends, you know, family friends.
Right.
And in no time, we became friends at Polesmore.
And what kinds of things would he smuggle in for you?
Well, first of all, I didn't ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
But because we became friends there, we are still friends, his wife used to bake unasked a Christmas cake for me.
Oh, wow.
And he used to smuggle it in. She still does it.
She still gives you a Christmas cake every year.
And now she does a birthday cake as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. God, that's so...
So because we are now we've been friends.
How often do you see each other?
Very often. When I was in, Cape Town, he pops in, sometimes with his wife. And when he was in, we especially got him to come to Joburg with his wife a few months ago to launch his book. We launched it at Constitution Hill, and he came with his wife and spent a lot of time together here too.
I love the fact that that's the first story you tell. It's not the important political things or anything to do with newspapers or news or what was happening outside. It's the personal story. It's this man who was your warder and his wife bringing you Christmas cakes. I think that's so spectacularly lovely. It just shows you that real humanity does win out in the end, right?
Well, you know, Madiba had warned us, don't take advantage of the young warders. Including Brandt.
Yes.
When he was isolated from us, Madiba had warned us beforehand that we are not to use him to carry messages to him. Just because he's young and he'll do anything. So we were very careful about exploiting him. But we bribed the elder warders.
Yes.
We bribed one old man. We didn't bribe him. Huh? We blackmailed. I didn't blackmail him. He came to me.
How do you blackmail a warder when you're in prison?
Well, I sent him to Mac Maharaj. What Mac did, he wrote a note. He tells this warder, and this warder had 2 years to go before retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Take it to Walter Sisulu and bring back his reply. We are all locked up, you see, at night.
Mm-hmm.
And this warder innocently done that. Now, I couldn't do this. I sent him to Mac. Now, when he came back, Mac tells him, I've now got your fingerprints. And if you don't play ball, you know what will happen. The poor chap panicked. What can I do? He says, bring us the newspaper every day.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Every
that's
night
how you
that
get
you
the
come.
Newspaper.
So I said, that's blackmail. But we were heavily criticized by Walter and Madiba.
Really? They didn't approve of this?
They said, you can't do a thing like this. But they welcomed the news.
I'm sure, because you would have then given them
because
the news.
For 16 years, we didn't have newspapers. So we Absolutely. Had to smuggle.
What were the things that you really appreciated getting while you were in prison because they were so hard to find? The things that you really needed that you didn't have.
Well, as I said, children.
Yeah.
That was the main thing. I used to stand on my bench because my cell looked out towards the harbor.
Yes.
Just stand there for hours just to see the warders and their families walking to the harbor with children. So at a distance too, just to see children was wonderful. Even to hear a child cry, you want it. Because we didn't see children for years and years. As I said, I saw a child after 20 years for the first time. You know, as we are sitting here, I saw a child, touched a child. She sat on my lap. But that was at Portsmouth.
It's just incredible to think of how long and how hard and how arduous that journey must have been. And those are difficult times too. I mean, even when you came out of prison, There was probably a lot of acclimatization to be done because the world was changing around you, but you'd been removed from it for such a long time. What surprised you the most when you came out of prison? Because be locked up for 20 years with no connection.
No, 26 years?
26 years, but at that stage, yeah.
This comedian, Riyad Musa,
yes,
has said in one of his stand-up comedies, Nelson Mandela served 27 years.
Yes.
Ahmed Kathrada, because he's an Indian, he asked for a discount. So he got 1 year discount. 26 years.
But when you finally make it out of prison now, things like a microwave oven.
Yeah, well.
You didn't know that
the first thing, when we were transferred to Johannesburg prison, and the night thereafter, the order came to us, the head order. We have just received a fax from prison headquarters to say you are going to be released tomorrow. Our question, what is the fax?
Of course, you wouldn't have known.
Yeah, we didn't know. We heard of this animal called fax, but to conceptualize how you put in a piece of paper. No, we came out in, the whole technological revolution just passed us by. ATMs. I still can't operate an ATM.
Really?
The first time this friend of mine who was 18 years in prison, well, he was released before us.
Yes.
So when I was released, we were together and we tried to get some money from ATM and the machine swallowed our cards. We didn't know this thing. So everything was new to us. The road system was completely new.
Yeah.
Everything was new.
Was it hard to get used to all of these things?
You know, it just comes. You accept things as they come. I was caught in the rain, sitting in the car, not driving, stationary, but the window was open.
Yes.
And when it rained, I'm looking for the handle. So I don't know about the buttons.
Electric windows.
To close the windows. So I got wet.
Oh, my God.
But that type of thing, technology, you know, slowly.
You catch on. But they do say that prisoners sometimes are institutionalized, that they become so used to prison ways. You even said you wake up now on prison time still. Are there any other remnants of that institutionalized thinking that they try to make you almost like a machine in prison? Anything that remains besides the waking up early?
Cold showers.
You don't take hot showers?
I do.
Yes.
The difference now is I soap myself and wash myself with hot water, but I must end with a cold shower.
Really?
No matter how cold, I've been in the American winter, I've been in the Swedish winter, I must end with a cold shower. That's a habit. What I cannot do very easily is go straight into a cold shower.
No.
That would be difficult. But after a warm soaping all and washing off the soap, I must go into a cold shower.
That's
one of the good habits.
I've heard that actually helps with the blood circulation. I don't know if that's true, though.
See?
I've heard that having a cold shower helps with your blood circulation. I don't know if that's true, though.
The doctors say that, and it must be true. Yeah.
And now, when life isn't having to do media interviews and having to tell your story to historians and people who are writing biographies, do you have any time to just relax and be with your family and friends?
Oh, yes.
You do get some time. Yeah. They're giving you, because I know for Madiba that was difficult towards the end.
Madiba was very difficult.
Yeah.
No, we've got this foundation, and they deal with my entire program. But they are very careful not to load me with too many things. Now and then, it does happen that one thing comes one after the other. But
do you ever get grumpy and say to them it's enough?
So otherwise they do spread out my appointments.
And you don't get grumpy with them and say sometimes this is enough now.
Not really.
I'm amazed at how even tempered. I suppose this is also something that you learned, is unbelievable self discipline.
Yes, no. You have to have two things in jail, discipline and humor.
Right, and you have both of those in bucket
loads. You just have to have that. I mean, a friend of ours got into an argument with a warder.
Yes.
And we were lined up to go to work. And they came out from the passage arguing, shouting at each other. And when we saw them, this man, Raymond Mtlaba, couldn't swear. So we are saying, swear the chap. All he could say is, you're fascist. These old chaps can't swear. No. They all had mission education, mission schools. So when I was transferred to Portsmouth alone, yes, and the old chaps were there, I said, the first thing I did is I went to the doctor. I said, please take me back. Here are old chaps. I respect them. I love them. They don't swear, they don't laugh at handicap, and what am I going to do with this? They wouldn't transfer me back to Robben Island, so I had to adjust.
You had to stay there at Polsmore with them.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that people are probably most interested in is this friendship that you had with Madiba. I think it's something that you have to keep telling. And you may be tired of it, but I know he meant an enormous amount to you. And this time last year, we were all still worried about his health, and it was a month before he would eventually die. And I think that event affected many millions of South Africans, justifiably. But when someone who was as close to him as you were is in the room, I have to ask how you felt and what you were thinking.
Well, I went to see him, and it was with great difficulty when he was in hospital.
In Pretoria, the heart hospital?
Yeah.
Yes.
And he had pipes in his mouth and so forth, so he couldn't communicate. He could communicate with his eyes. So he just held my hands tight, could listen to what I am saying, just hands tight. And that was the last I saw him.
What did you say to him?
Just, the everyday thing, so-and-so sends regards and so, things like that. And he could just sort of signal to me that he has heard what I've said. But I couldn't bear to see him again in that condition. That was also a brief few minutes, but it was too much.
Was it just you and him in the room?
It was just the two of us. Then, of course, Mrs. Moshel was outside, and she controlled all visitors. And with me too, she said it's time up, but it was just as well.
Right. You never wanted to see him after that because it was just too painful?
No, it was too difficult.
And then when he died after that, I mean, you know, he was an older man. He wasn't in the best of health by that stage, so you knew it was coming. But you can never be prepared for that sort of thing.
No, it was. Well, you've accepted that he's not going to be with us for long. But when it happens, it still hits you. I was at a function in Johannesburg, a small function, about Madiba. And I got a message on my cell phone that he is not going to survive the night. And I had to speak there about him. But I've got this message that he's not going to survive. It was very, very difficult to keep this to yourself. I mean, I told my colleague, that's all. And you had to talk about him, knowing that he's not going to see the daylight. That would happen. It was a small crowd that was it.
God.
It was very difficult. But one had to steel oneself just for this, to go through that night.
And who gave you the news?
I can't remember now.
Somebody
from the household phoned me.
All right. And was this in the morning or still in the evening? Did they wake you in the evening?
I can't remember anymore.
Sure.
That day, chronologically, I can't really exactly remember what happened and who told me and when. I couldn't remember. Possible Zelda, but all likelihood it could have been her. But I don't know. It was somebody from the household.
Someone called Claudia wants to know on WeChat. Please ask Mr. Katrada if he's still angry about what all of you went through. Are you still angry? Are you angry?
No. Anger, hatred, bitterness, revenge. They're all negative emotions. People who harbor those emotions suffer more than people towards whom it is directed. So no, fortunately, I don't harbor any emotions of bitterness or hatred or revenge. And that applies to most of us. One can't lead your lives living with feelings of revenge or bitterness. As I say, you suffer more harboring those negative emotions.
I'm so happy to have had the opportunity to talk to you this morning, and you are, whether you like it or not now, the chronicler of this part of our history. I think we're in safe hands if you can keep telling this story and reminding people of what's happened before, because we do tend to take for granted, and we do tend to forget history.
Mm-hmm.
And thank goodness you're around to remind us of these things, and long may you be around to keep reminding us, Mr. Ahmed Kathrada.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for everything you've done.
Thank you. And thanks to the listeners.
Your part in the history of this country is illustrious, and we are very, very lucky to have had you.
Oh, thank you for your kind words.
And I appreciate you coming through this morning, and I'm sorry that you had to wake up early prison time to be here, but I'm sure your cold shower woke you up better than me.
No, that's just routine getting up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for
having me. It's a pleasure to see you.
Right, yeah.
Ahmed Kathrada. It's 8:09, cliffcentral.com. I'm sure you'd agree, just one of those amazing stories that you couldn't explain it better than the person who's the lead character in the story ever could. It's a thrill to be able to share some time with someone who's lived through this amazing period of our history with some of these amazing people, and is himself an amazing person.